Good morning, this is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for April 4th. Yet another crazy week on planet Earth, what with some real movement to finally resolve the fate of Chrysler and General Motors, for better or worse, and an economic summit that actually mattered, the G20 in London. But in the end, the mood, at least in London, as world leaders of 20 leading industrialized and developing nations met, was perhaps best encapsulated in the interaction between Michelle Obama and Queen Elizabeth II. The horror! Michelle touched the Queen. Ah, but Queen Elizabeth came through and made sure the world knew it was quite all right. In fact, she's rather fond of Barack and Michelle, and thus another crisis was averted. In the same fashion, what was initially deemed to be a testy affair, the G20, turned out to be just the right gathering for these times. Don't get me wrong, nothing of substance was accomplished, save additional funds for the IMF. But it reminded me of a Christmas party I had years ago from my condo complex, for adults only, when my neighbors brought their very cute little three-year-old, and I was horrified as Daisy proceeded to run roughshod all over the place, threatening my few valuable possessions. I mean, she touched and handled everything, but what was I to do? I couldn't correct her. I wanted the parents to do that. But in the end, Daisy didn't break anything, much to my relief. And that's how it looked this week in London, with the likes of French President Sarkozy threatening to take his toys and go home if he didn't have his way, and German Chancellor Angela Merkel's incessant pouting and foot-stomping of her own. The meeting could have devolved into a shouting match with competing press conferences, with all then pointing to President Obama and the nation he represents. They did it! It was them! America ruined the world! Alas, with some last-minute negotiations on how to handle tax havens, brokered by President Obama, a very bland communique was issued, and everyone went home satisfied that their constituencies wouldn't immediately throw any of them out of office, at least until the next crisis. And for Barack Obama, it's still early days, but this was his finest hour. He played the role of humble American, much of that which has transpired in the financial world truly being our fault, yet he managed to walk the tightrope in defending the United States while issuing apologies some of the other leaders wanted to hear. But that's just my opinion. As for what others might think, this is from an editorial in the Washington Post. The meeting in London of leaders of 20 top world economies produced a number of pledges of useful action to cope with the global recession, increased economic coordination, a reaffirmed commitment to open trade and assistance to developing nations. These are all hugely important if leaders follow through. And the conversations among the 20 countries are useful in and of themselves, the type of coordination that must accompany a tightly linked global economy. But the summit would have benefited from a greater focus on the U.S. priority of fixing the crisis we are in before moving on to protecting against the next one. Entering the summit, there was a tension between the U.S. desire to focus on economic repair and France and Germany's interest in using the summit as a launching pad for a more coordinated financial regulatory regime. Perhaps President Obama could have pushed harder. On the other hand, he was handicapped by worldwide belief in U.S. culpability for the crisis and residual resentments of perceived U.S. high-handedness under the previous administration. Mr. Obama wanted to represent U.S. interests without appearing to bully other participants. When asked how he thought he did, Mr. Obama said, "I think we did okay. That sounds about right." That was an editorial in the Washington Post. Turning to a roundup of the economic news on the week, in China there were conflicting reports on manufacturing. One day, an independent survey said manufacturing in March was below the 50 line, meaning further contraction, but then the government's official figure had it above 50 at 52.4, the strongest such number since May 2008. As I've noted before, the last thing you can do is rely on one data point when it comes to China. No doubt, some good things are happening here in terms of stabilizing the situation, but real growth at 8% plus, that's for the second half of the year at best. In Japan, the Tonkan survey of business sentiment found the mood of manufacturers at a record low in March, industrial production down 9.4% in February, and unemployment still on the rise, but inventories have been slashed at a record pace, which bodes well for the future. The inventory picture is the same around the world and eventually will lead to greatly increased economic activity. The question is, for how long will it then be sustained? Germany's unemployment rate hit 8.6%. And Russia's GDP is now estimated to plunge 5.6% in 2009. But the picture was mixed in Britain, and that could be a good thing, as there were signs housing was stabilizing there, with home prices actually up in March for the first time since October 2007, as home buyers rushed to take advantage of low interest rates. While, as an aside, others were paying down their mortgages at record levels in order to get back into positive equity. For the record, the London luxury market, however, is still seeing declining prices, as it should. As for the data in the U.S., while the trend has been for receiving better than expected news, even if the actual numbers were still largely putrid, this week the picture was decidedly mixed. Manufacturing, as represented by the Chicago PMI and the ISM, was still very much in recession territory, with Chicago's 31.4 reading downright dreadful. But construction spending, while negative, was better than expected, and factory orders were up 1.8% when a 1.4% increase was forecast. But then we had this payroll number for March, another 663,000 lost jobs and an unemployment rate of 8.5%, the highest since November 1983. You can't sugarcoat it in any fashion unless you are an insensitive dolt. We also know the 8.5% understates the real picture. Since the recession officially started in December 2007, 5 million jobs have been lost. As for housing, the S&P Case-Shiller Index for 20 major metropolitan areas had home prices down 19% for the 3 months ending in January compared with a year earlier, another record decline. The damage in Phoenix and Las Vegas remained the worst, down 35% and 32% respectively. We also learned defaults and delinquencies continue to rise rapidly, and the condition of commercial real estate has been downgraded to critical from serious. But the Case-Shiller data is for January, and there have been more recent signs that residential housing is stabilizing in some areas. I'm liking my April-May bottom in terms of median home values more and more, but each time I bring this up, I feel compelled to add, once the bottom has been reached, we sit there. As in, don't expect a sudden surge in traffic at the lemonade stand you've set up to bring in a few extra coins. Which brings us to the auto sector. First off, the March sales numbers were awful. GM down 45% over year earlier levels, Ford down 41%, Chrysler down 39%, Toyota down 39%, and Honda off 36%. But sales were up 25% over February, so have we bottomed? In Germany, auto sales rose 11.9% over a year ago thanks to a highly successful Cash for Clunkers incentive program whereby one receives $3,300 for their old car. Don't be surprised to see a similar incentive here in short order. It makes too much sense, though some would argue, particularly environmentalists, I imagine, that we wouldn't necessarily be then buying the right kind of cars, to which I'd say it's about jobs. I'll worry about the polar bear next month. Anyway, on Monday, we had a classic case of wait 24 hours as a hue and cry went up in some quarters over the dismissal of General Motors CEO Rick Wagoner. The heavy hand of government at work, an extraordinary intervention of the federal government into management of a private company, said some. At the same time, the White House's auto task force gave Chrysler 30 days to wrap up a deal with Fiat, while GM was given 60 days to come up with a final solution. Turning to Wall Street, I believe the lows in the stock market are definitely in. Oh, sure, there will be corrections from existing levels. We've now had four straight up weeks for the first time since September-October 2007, after all, which happened to be when we hit the all-time highs. But ask me if I'm changing my forecast from December last year that we will finish significantly up in 2009. Of course not. After the awful start this year, I kind of thought of the market as a basketball game. Down 20, meaning 20%+. You're just trying to make up a lot of ground by June 30th, halftime, and then go from there. That's my feeling today, and in terms of NASDAQ, which I said would outperform the Dow and S&P, it's now already in positive territory. I won't change my 50-50 cash equities allocation yet, however. There's still a ton of uncertainty, including the geopolitical scene as well as the coming bank stress test results. And then you have earnings. The news for the first quarter won't be good, and it's not likely to be in the second either, but if I'm right, sometime in the May-June time period, you'll hear the first real positive statements from key CEOs that had previously been down in the mouth, talking of some semblance of recovery in business by early 2010. Morgan Stanley CEO John Mack's comment that 2009 was going to be a difficult year didn't hurt the market. Even as Mack said, there is still a ton of toxic debt on bank books, and it's thus no time to give back $10 billion Morgan Stanley received from the TARP fund. Treasury Secretary Geithner added last weekend on This Week that the banks will require more capital, large amounts of assistance, as he put it, Yet again, this was already baked in the cake, it seems. Stocks instead rallied largely on the positive vibes from the G20 summit, as well as a bullish interpretation of the economic data and the change in mark-to-market accounting. For the week, the Dow Jones rose 3.1% to 8,017, while the S&P 500 added 3.3% to 842 and NASDAQ 4.9% to 1621. In the case of the S&P, the rally off the March 9 closing low of 676 is now 24.5%. Not only the best four-week performance since 1938, but also the best closing mark in 2 months for both the Dow and S&P. NASDAQ is now up 2.8% on the year, though the Dow and S&P are still off 9 and 7% respectively. Quite an improvement nonetheless. On mark-to-market, the real impact on equities, particularly the banking sector, took place about 3 weeks ago when it first seemed likely some provisions would change in early April, when the ruling came down, giving banks more flexibility in how they valued some of their toxic, illiquid paper. It was anticlimactic. As for future bank earnings, it is unclear what the true impact will be, as of today, that is. Lastly, March ended up being the best month since October 2002, up 8.5% for the S&P 500, though the index was still down 11.7% for the quarter. That's your abbreviated week in review for April 4th. I'll be back with you next week.